Okay. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the final Friday seminar of the academic year. Joining us today is Phil Wilcox, who is a research associate at Bielefeld University, Germany, in the Faculty of Sociology. Phil completed her PhD in social anthropology at Goldsmiths University in 2018, based on her ethnography in Luang Prabang, studying how people live in and around socialist political system in Laos. A monograph based on the thesis is out in the coming months with the Amsterdam University Press titled Heritage in the Making of Political Legitimacy in Laos, Past and Present of the Lao Nation. We have the pleasure of having Phil join us today to talk about her more recent research, comparing perceptions of China and Chinese-backed development across the global South, which she will present to us today in the seminar titled, presentation seminar titled China and Lao, Rethinking Development in the Belt and Road Era. So without further ado, Phil, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, and thank you all very much for coming. It's a real honor to be here. I will just start screen sharing. Just bear with me a second while I do that. You would kind of think I'd be used to this in the pandemic time by now. Hopefully everybody can see that, and everyone can still hear me fine, hopefully. Okay, so on the 9th of November, 2018, an article entitled Lao People's Dream, Laos China Railway Takes Away Poverty, appeared in the state-owned Vientiane Times. It began by stating that Laos is an extremely underdeveloped country and how the Lao-China Railway would not only bring prosperity to the Lao population, but would also create new opportunities for friendship between Laos and China. In detail, it advised readers that the railway, the first of its kind in Laos, has strong Lao government support, and that while there will be an upheaval of people for the building of the railway, everything will be done under sufficiently stringent laws and in a spirit of generosity and goodwill. Responding directly to critics, the article concluded, quote, in constructing the railway, the two countries will cooperate with each other and understand each other, because it is not only a traffic artery, but more like a friendship bridge linking the people of the two countries. Thanks to the Laos-China Railway, all things will be better, wherever in China or Laos, end quote. The notion that a railway can make everything better speaks to a universal vision of what Reeves has termed infrastructural hope, especially of projects involving transport and connectivity, and speaks to an almost totalizing hope of national improvement through development of mega infrastructural and amenity development. In academic terms, infrastructure projects have long been understood in development discourse and scholarship as being about economic advancement as well as improved understanding between communities. And this is particularly true of mega infrastructure projects such as the Laos-China Railway. Sorry, I'm just having a slight difficulty in moving to the next slide. Bear with me a second. Not totally sure why this is happening. So on the left of the slide, we have a map of contemporary Laos, and on the right, a map of the route the railway will be taking. So it's going to link Kunming in Yunnan province with Vientiane, the Lao capital, by approximately half the territory of Laos, and then crossing to Thailand. And this is going to cut the travel time between Vientiane and Luang Prabang, the main city in the north part of Laos, from a 10-hour bus journey over some mountains to approximately 1 hour. And this is before any consideration of how the railway will improve everything in less tangible terms, not only in Laos, but also in China, and what will be gained and lost by linking the two countries much more closely together. On almost any reckoning, the coming Lao-China Railway represents a major change in Laos and is demonstrative of far-reaching ambitions and aspirations for the future. In talking about development through infrastructure, which mirrors a lot of official macro-level discourse of development in Laos, I focus a lot here on the railway, but I'm not apologizing for that because this is the most visible and ambitious infrastructure project in the country and a key symbol of what I'll term the doing of development in Laos, as well as a useful lens through which to view Laos in the Belt and Road era. This is a vision of a future in which Chinese dreams are exported to the global South and elsewhere, with the resulting economic successes available to those who accept and pursue these dreams as something they want the future to look like. The coming railway is also representative of the coming of age of Laos as a country graduated from the UN class of least developed countries. And this is a status that the Lao government has long hoped to shed by 2025, and for the country to become a middle income country in the years that follow. Whether this really will reduce poverty in Laos and benefit much of its population of 7 million people, most of whom are subsistence rice farmers, is questionable, with Lavin observing that it is actually in the interest of Laos to retain that least developed status for as long as possible because of some of the benefits that such a status offers. But whatever private concerns exist, developing the country has become what Tapper has observed as a sort of national obsession on behalf of the Lao authorities. Few, me included, would deny the need for development in Laos. The preoccupation of development through large-scale infrastructure projects, however, is not without problems and concern for their long-term implications. In 2019, the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty criticized the Lao government for prioritizing infrastructure projects as a means of poverty reduction, noting that while the Lao economy has shown impressive growth, it is not all good news, with reservations about the sustainability of such growth, growing inequality, and 80% of the population still living on less than $2.50 a day. And this paper was written before COVID arrived in Laos last month, but I'm happy to share what I've heard from Laos in the last few weeks in the Q&A if people are interested. China, Chinese interests, and Chinese actors in the Global South are not as new as they might first appear, and Lovell rightly points out that global Maoism actually has a long history. China as an alternative path to development also displaces what can be viewed as the hegemony of doing development that is based in the global north and often exported to the global south with minimal discussion and consultation. So here I arrive at the first starting point for the paper, a hypothesis that China as a driver of development in Laos acts as an unsettling force for how a lot of development has been done. Consider, for example, that many of us have donated money over the years to aid organizations working in the global south. And we've been told, as donors, that we can help alleviate poverty and that in so doing, we will make a difference. We are also told that in developing, countries in the global south should prioritize the strength of civil society organizations and the development of multi-party democracy. And this is important because prevailing wisdom on development in the global north still largely sees the growth of such things as both an important part of the process and outcome of development. China, as a driver of development, is sometimes referred to as an emerging donor or a game changer because its rise as an overt driver and example of development in the global south is still fairly new. And that has risen in profile enormously since the Belt and Road era began. As an indication of that, Gollian Song argued in 2011 that in managing its rising influence, China would also have to find ways to do this that are palatable to the international community. And a decade on, that statement looks rather naive, as China is increasingly able to set the rules. People of Chinese heritage in Laos are not themselves new. Vientiane, capital of Laos, has long had an area known as Chinatown. However, what is new is a direct link made by many Lao and others across the global south between people of Chinese heritage and the contemporary state of China. And this is what Li argues when she talks about the scepter of global China in her recent book and how that's haunting much of the planet. And I'll talk here about how people in Laos engage with that. I also want to start from something that I think is quite often overlooked, especially when comparing Laos with its neighbours. Laos is a really poor country, and accordingly, it's quite a good place to think through ideas about development, priorities of donors and recipients, agency, particularly of recipients, but moreover, what this looks like on an everyday level. Development in Laos, to my interlocutors, and in a lot of official discourse, is often expressed as a reduction in poverty, improved services such as health and education, and better amenities. And while reducing corruption has been highlighted to me as a significant concern by friends in Laos, a robust growth of civil society with meaningful options to challenge the authoritarian system, a long-term preoccupation of much overseas development aid from the global north, is not emphasized. I'll begin by talking about the context of development in Laos briefly, which also takes us to the heart of Sino-Lao relations and the historically close relationships Laos has had with other nations as drivers of development. I regard development as a contested field in which different donors export their experience and ambitions for the country. And I argue that these are increasingly challenged with the arrival of China as a new driver and an example of development in Laos. And here, I also want to suggest a paradox, and this is just a suggestion at this stage, but decades of overseas development aid from the global north demonstrate that development agendas have become less about poverty reduction per se, and more about the realization of individual rights. And of course, that's quite apparent when we look at the work of Sen and Nussbaum, Sen in particular. Arguably, in encouraging people to claim rights and development autonomy, one consequence of that is that individuals and collectives in Laos and elsewhere may choose a future involving China. And as I'll show here, that's not always done through a totally free choice. But as one of my interlocutors pointed out to me with a rather ironic smile, you have to develop with someone. And if there are any Bob Dylan fans out there listening to this, you know, we could also think about that in terms of, you know, you always have to serve somebody, right? Literature on China in the developing world recognizes the breadth of Chinese influence, but is split between those who take China's neo-colonizing agenda as self-evident and those who regard that as a very dangerous generalization. I'm in the second category, and I also wish to stress that individuals and groups have different levels of agency in engaging with China. That does not mean, however, that everyone negotiates in the same way with the same possibilities. And I think this leads to a situation of what I'm going to term pragmatic and often contradictory engagement with China. And that is that people in Laos are aware of the enormous potential that growing Chinese influence and Chinese actors have as a driver of change. And their fears about this often run very deep too. And it's essential to take those seriously. At the same time, they may engage very actively with Chinese actors around them for a variety of reasons, including future building for themselves. And I'll show a few examples of that. Overall, China's growing influence in the global South can and should make us think again and critically about agendas of development, priorities, practices and assumptions. And while it may be very difficult for donors in the global north to contemplate that after decades of development work in the global south, local populations there may move closer to a vision of the future offered by China, it is essential to consider how and why this happens, and the time to do that is now. In Imagined Communities, Anderson writes of the importance of borders as a means of identification, of defining something against something else. This is particularly important in the case of a country such as Laos, which only really exists as a colonial product. French colonialism in Laos, which unified the country as an entity in 1899, brought relatively little in terms of development. And this is partly because Laos was governed by the French starting relatively late, and for a relatively short time. It is also, as Holt suggests, that the French colonizers were fairly uninterested in this territory that they acquired as a result of colonial efforts elsewhere in the region. The influence of France in Laos now is quite small, and that has much to do with events since independence for Laos in the 1950s. Following independence, the US involvement in the Laos Civil War, in which the US sponsored and conducted a massive aerial bombing campaign in Laos as part of their attempts to crush the growth of communism in Vietnam, and in attempts to stop the Lao communists gaining traction in Laos. And those efforts lasted several decades, culminating with the withdrawal of the US and the establishment of one-party socialist regimes in both Vietnam and Laos in 1975. That is probably the quickest sprint through some of Lao history ever, but there are some really important points from that. Firstly, it fuses together notions of development with outsiders, and this book cover, I think, illustrates that really, really well. More crucially, it also positions Laos as a major point in other people's development strategies and demonstrates a relatively weak national consciousness in Laos itself. The story of national liberation in Laos is one of Laos establishing its own legitimate form of governance through the expulsion of undesirable influences and their American and colonial backers. But as with most stories around nationalism, this is selective and fragmented, and significantly most of the educated population, as well as large segments of the population who didn't support communism, left the country around the time of the revolution. Laos is not, however, an exact reflection of Vietnam. While its political trajectory since 1975 does show some very strong similarities, though, from the introduction of collective farming to its abandonment within a decade. We then see, as in Vietnam, economic reforms from the mid-1980s and subsequent reopening of the country to capitalist investment from overseas. Crucially, we also see the Lao authorities remaining involved in that process of change rather than being swept along by it. And this is what Yamada has termed the legitimation of authoritarianism. I believe that this is perhaps the most significant reason why the one-party system in Laos has survived for so long. It has shown a remarkable ability to reinvent itself and to promote that reinvention. Arguably, this leading from the front is now taking on a different form, because as we saw at the start of this paper, with the Lao authorities essentially selling what is known as the Chinese railway as something good for the population and the country. I believe that how the Lao authorities are able to manage their relationship with China is crucial for the current era of legitimacy and ensuring that the population continue to be happy with the political status quo. Crucially, this increasingly close relationship with China is a significant change in direction because it has come at a cost of the historically close relationship with the big brother country, Vietnam. All in all, I suggest then that Laos has become much more aware of its northern neighbor in the last two decades, which isn't very surprising as traffic across the border, both of products and people, has increased. And again, what is interesting here is the numbers of people of Chinese heritage being connected to the contemporary Chinese state and how that has increased in volume. I'm particularly interested in transport because I'm interested in transport projects carrying with them this double ability to consolidate boundaries, but also to bring people closer together across those boundaries. And obviously there's quite a lot of that in scholarship on infrastructure of transport. Here, railways promise to unite people and to connect them at speed on shiny trains. I have heard progressively more and more about China in Laos over the last 15 years, and some of that is undoubtedly because I began to pay more attention to it. In 2013, I sat down with a businesswoman in Vientiane who told me for the first time about the Chinese train. And as this is such a major change for Laos to have this direct train line, I asked her what she thought about it. She told me confidently that it was crazy and would never happen. And at that time, very few people in Laos had seen a train outside of what they saw on Thai television. But happen it has, and agreements were signed and broken for the railway in winter of 2015. And this is one of those kind of ceremonies you often get at the start of a construction project of people in suits with rakes doing things with piles of earth. Details of the finances of the railway and similar schemes are not public. However, we do know that as far back as 2016, the overall debt of China, of Laos to China, exceeded the country's GDP. Radio Free Asia in 2018 referred to the coming railway as a fast track to debt and dependency on China. And this is again something the UN Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty noted in his report on Laos in 2019. And he noted that the value of China-backed infrastructure projects alone in Laos exceeded the country's GDP 2 years earlier. Secondly, while attention from the international media has focused heavily on railway construction, it's not the only infrastructure project. Here we can think of roads, but also of hydropower. And this latter point is particularly important when we think about the dam in Laos that collapsed in the summer of 2018, causing widespread homelessness and the deaths of around 40 people. And these are some of the refugees from the dam collapse. While the Lao authorities work very hard to present that as a natural disaster, scholars are almost unanimous in this being an entirely foreseeable and avoidable tragedy caused by poor management and administration. This particular dam had Korean funding, and again, that speaks to the role of outsiders in Lao development. It was also producing electricity that would be exported to Thailand, living up to the Lao government project of harnessing Lao hydropower, making Laos the battery of Southeast Asia. As Johnson noted in his recent book, these ambitions speak volumes. This is why one of the official seals of Laos has a hydropower dam on it. Again, this visibility of doing development. That electricity doesn't power Laos, but elsewhere. And who wins out of such projects in Laos itself is very open to debate. But such projects have enormous appeal to the Lao authorities for several reasons, with further dams planned. I was actually just reading about one over lunch. In my opinion, this is partly because they do development, do it quickly, and do it very visibly. Literally, this shows the country is developing and speaks to that ambition and promise of development. One of my interlocutors in Lumpurbang asked me, you know, why are you so interested in the railway anyway, given it's not the only foreign-backed or even Chinese-backed project in Laos? I'm not arguing that this is the only way to consider the state of development in Laos, but it is a useful medium to think through how people feel about the landscape changing around them, the actions of Chinese actors, and where they think those are coming from. And because it's a railway, more people are likely to encounter it at different points than hydropower projects. Also, it serves to put forward an essential point. And again, this sort of visibility of doing development and this public statement that Laos is going places, even if scrutiny of the details of that isn't public and many people wonder privately about the cost of it. Excuse me just a second. In talking of visions then of future building, it's well worth taking a historical perspective. From the Marshall Plan offering American money to those wishing to fight communism, I would argue that the sometimes unspoken message of development is that it hopes to reproduce an image of the donor, in that case, some sort of reproduction of the US, and not always an unspoken sentiment either, take this funding and its priorities. China as a driver of development in the global south, as we've said, is not totally new. And arguably the Belt and Road is an extension of that, albeit one that comes with much more fanfare and aims to put China far more prominently and centrally on the geopolitical stage as a major actor of development. I would argue that the Belt and Road represents perhaps for the first time a very overt Chinese version of the Marshall Plan and offers a different strategy in future building. This displaces ideas of the global north as the only realistic driver of development and introduces the notion that there are multiple versions of the future to which one can aspire, both individually and collectively. And what is particularly interesting about Belt and Road is its rhetoric around shared benefits for all the states that participate in it, arguing that developing along these lines then is a choice. And I suggest here that in Laos, we have a heady mixture of desire and pragmatism on individual and collective levels. I argue that the Lao authorities are not entirely on board with any vision of development in regard to those articulated in the global north. If they were, why would they get into this possibility of development backed by China with its high risk financial obligations, as we see in such projects? But whatever the positive outward message about connecting more closely with China, they work with other donors too. So I suggest here that they calculate both gains, costs, expectations, priorities of themselves and other stakeholders. Now, jumping slightly to another context, the late Prime Minister of Tanzania picked up on this very acutely when in 2018, in an interview with the BBC, he stated that Tanzania now prefers China's aid to that of Western countries because it comes with fewer conditions. In my opinion, it's not particularly difficult to see why he might have come to that conclusion. China isn't very interested in questions of democracy or gay rights in the global south. and maintains strongly that whatever it is doing, it is not concerning itself with internal political affairs, focusing on development as a means for connectivity through the rhetoric of mutual benefits to both China and recipient countries. However, it is a myth to say that China's aid, whether in the forms of loans or anything else, comes without conditions. Support for China's stance vis-a-vis Taiwan is a clear one. And in a really good forthcoming essay, Ho and Sims argue that non-interference in politics is a myth because one cannot separate politics from economics. We know in anthropology that just being somewhere has consequences. And in relation to China in Laos, I prefer the arguments made by Lampton et al. In their new book about railroads and Chinese power in Southeast Asia. Namely, that by doing things that are beneficial to Chinese interests, even if they are also useful elsewhere, that is not agenda-free. They note, quote, power exists when a country is able to tilt the international business and development playing fields in its direction. China is seeking to do just that, end quote. So in sum, I suggest that China is indeed exporting an image of itself to the global south, setting itself up as a prominent alternative vision of the future in the process. And shared benefits of development sounds great, but as with most visions of the future, sharing does not mean sharing equally. So I suggest then that Lao people have learned to be quite cynical about promises of development. And the friend who was with me when I took this photo said, oh, me, Kon Kwam Suk, Het Lok Phai, or happy people do the railway, Phil. China's involvement in Laos is far from homogeneous. Starting at the Lao-China border, there are two special economic zones, both of which are primarily casino developments. Sims, in 2017, talked about the Lao government's attitude to these as one of gambling on the future. With gambling illegal in China, it's not very surprising that these developments have appeared in Laos, and they have a very colourful reputation, often as places where bad behaviour abounds and it's possible to flout local laws. And this process has been termed one of commodifying sovereignty, which is a very good description. In official terms, and to the Lao population, they are builders' places where the Lao government earns revenue for leasing the land, which in turn helps to develop the country. And this is one of the casino developments which I took from the Thai side, and I cycled up the river hoping to get this photo, and I can remember thinking, am I actually going to know when I get there? And I thought, well, if it really does have a gold crown on it, I think you'll know. Later on, I asked some local traders what they thought about this, and they told me that it's a vulgar place for people with money, which actually mirrors a rather unpleasant stereotype about how many Chinese are seen in Laos more generally. Interestingly, the businessman behind this development was sanctioned by the US in 2015, but according to the Laotian Times, is now reported to be looking for new possibilities for development in the south of the country. Turning land into capital is another great slogan, and it's a serious policy by the Lao authorities, and it's been a cornerstone of development policy there for nearly a decade, transpiring as leasing land to raise capital through things like the special economic zones, through the establishments of large farms on long-term leases, which are typically used to grow bananas or rubber. I understand the authorities have now issued some regulations on land use following widespread concerns about pesticides, but amongst my interlocutors in the northwest of Laos, several had worked on Chinese-owned banana farms and accepted what they considered to be very poor working conditions in exchange for a small payment. Other interlocutors worried that the land would become permanently degraded through such practices and therefore useless, or just that it wouldn't be returned. One told me that he worried that a desire to buy consumer goods would lead to a rush to sell land. And this speaks to what I believe to be the greatest fear about better links with China, that it is China itself that will literally come down the railway line and some other new roads and will change Laos in ways that cannot be easily controlled or reversed. While some Lao, particularly Lao students in China, indicated to me that they would travel on the railway if they could afford to do so, they felt that movement would be dwarfed by traffic in the other direction. It is very easy to see a country such as Laos, one of the poorest in the world with a very small population, as being dwarfed by the economic might of its northern neighbour. And that's a trope I see in a lot of travel writing and even occasionally in scholarship on Laos. But it is one that a growing number of scholars on Laos are rejecting, and rightfully so. Tan, for example, has argued strenuously that this is not a question of China arriving in Laos and taking over per se, and that what China does in Laos represents a very calculated decision by the Lao political establishment. In relation to the special economic zones particularly, she's argued that these allow for a vision of an alternative state formation in Laos, that the leasing of land to China and Chinese businesses represent more a discharge of responsibilities to those areas from the Lao authorities in allowing them to be governed by others. And this formation of what she terms indirect state rule does not happen passively, but is a calculated decision to pursue, as Ong would suggest, a privatization of certain areas in order to follow a strategy for developing the country. Alessandro Ripa recently suggested that this represents an active and passive role for the Lao authorities, active in terms of leasing the land, passive in terms of allowing other people to run it. It's also arguably more one than the other. But viewed in those terms, it's a very logical extension of turning land into capital, that policy I mentioned earlier. And the downside of this is that in moving to a more cash-based economy in a country that's really cash poor, with the land being the only real asset, that does not lead to sustainable growth. And there's been a worrying rise in homeless people in Vientiane in the last decade. And from talking to them, I understand several of them are people from the countryside who've lost their land and have very few other options for income. I would argue then that Tan is entirely correct that the Lao authorities are more active than is widely assumed in the process of rising China in Laos. However, to me, that is only half the picture. And where I think Tan is lacking is that even if her macro level analysis is right, that doesn't mean that concerns about China in Laos on the ground are not also very real. Even if one believes that building infrastructure projects in the country is of benefit, and even if one is willing to accept that there is more to China in Laos than a mere question of neocolonialism, yes, no, maybe, that is perhaps of small comfort to people who've told me about the pain of being relocated in the name of such projects. One interlocutor from south of Luang Prabang told me about an entire village near one of his relatives being relocated for an infrastructure project, and that its residents were compensated in money rather than replacement land. He worried that people would have no choice but to buy inferior land as a replacement, and that social relations would be destroyed with not much could be done about it. At the same time, young people, especially from ethnic minorities, talk often about few opportunities for employment or education in Laos. When I asked one of them who he thought the main winners would be from Laos student scholarships in China, he said he thought it would be both Laos and China. Laos students get a higher education that they would not access otherwise. In return, they learn Mandarin language and Chinese culture. Crucially, these students often then work for Chinese companies in Laos after graduation, often as translators. So here's another interesting suggestion, that while ethnic minorities are far more likely to be relocated in Laos for infrastructure projects, and therefore arguably the biggest losers out of such schemes, in other respects, they are also more likely to pursue opportunities involving Chinese actors as a result of their disadvantage in Laos, and may view this as a viable option to redress that disadvantage. This is a dynamic I have heard repeatedly. And as Johnson notes in his recent book about the Mekong River itself changing following the establishment of a dam in China, possibilities give rise to the possibility to do some things and not others. And the maybe of possibility really matters. Maybe developing with China is an attractive option for future building. Maybe it's the most viable option available. Maybe you get something you want, or maybe you don't. And the options for that are shifting. In another very interesting essay on this, Littleton and Lee noted that some Akar villages in northern Laos partnered willingly with Chinese businesses. But the deals that they struck were haunted by this overriding sentiment that the Akkar land was at risk of being taken away. In return, the Chinese that they partnered with thought that the Akkar were very unrealistic about what they could expect from Lao government agendas of development. And the Akkar sentiments speak to what I've termed here this sort of choosing with pragmatism, choosing a trajectory without being entirely positive about it. I find this echoed amongst Lao students who go to China. They gain something, but are aware that others gain more. The possibility, the maybe, offers something, but with consequences. So this means that China acts as an example of how Laos can develop, and that people engage pragmatically with Chinese actors in Laos. I've argued elsewhere and will repeat here that I think China operates as a sort of contradictory force with push factors and pull factors. While I was doing my doctoral research, I was asked to move the time of an informal English discussion group that I ran with some local young people because it clashed with a free Mandarin language class and they all wanted to go. And when I asked why, one of them told me, "I'm learning Chinese for the same reason that my grandfather's grandfather learned French. When the Chinese come, they're not going to be talking to us in Lao." At the same time, China represents development, visual, fast-track development, particularly in the form of amenities. China is developed is something I hear repeatedly when I visit Lao students in China. They often talk about public transport systems, or paying for stuff with your mobile phone. That second thing actually is increasing in Laos. But at the same time, they and many people in Laos, particularly in the northern part of the country, are very aware that the rise of China has consequences as they see Chinese plantations, hydropower, roads, railways as visual signs of change. That's an example of infrastructure having a double quality of what Reeves has termed the possibility of positivity, but also entrapment. Infrastructure studies make it very clear that it's not about the physical object per se, but about the meanings people place on it and its remit as a tool of statecraft, what it means for ideas of living in modernity and so on. In my opinion, that could all be applied to questions of development. While on research in Lumpabang in 2019, thinking specifically about perceptions of China as the railway became a reality around us and quite a close one, I would often cycle past the closest construction site, which is just north of Lumpabang City. Situated on a busy junction, I would often stop to buy a drink from a small stall next to the junction. As time went on, I got to know the seller a little bit. She told me that she had come to sell stuff on this junction to people going in and out of the site, but that once construction was concluded, she'd probably move on. And when I asked her what she thought of the railway project overall, she resorted to a very Lao strategy of dealing with a difficult question, of smiling and saying, I don't know. That indicated to me that perhaps she did have some thoughts on this, but wasn't going to share them with me, even a Lao-speaking foreigner. And that went somewhat better than the first time I tried to start a conversation with someone else on the junction. Without realizing that, like a lot of construction workers on China-backed projects, that person was Chinese and either didn't speak any Lao or wasn't going to speak it with me. One of my interlocutors, a Hmong man, lived quite close by though and was happy to talk about this at length. He took me up a track quite close to this mountain to his family's farmland and told me that tunnel boring for the railway is happening right underneath them. And he said, "Oh, stay here at nightfall, it's like an earthquake. My dad says it's like the war all over again." They are not to receive compensation for the construction as they are not being relocated because the railway is going under, not over their land. And although they were concerned about the project reducing their access to water and cutting off access to a place that they had historically buried dead people, I asked him overall what he thought about the railway and was quite surprised when he said that actually he wouldn't mind it coming so much. It's just that there was a cost for him and his family and the degradation of their land. But he said he wouldn't mind if it went underneath someone else's land. Taking a very long view of China in Laos, a theme that he and I had discussed for many years, he told me, "Laos is poor. It needs to develop. But there are two things about China in Laos. Firstly, it is good when more Chinese come to Laos. They will help to create more jobs, more businesses. But I'm a bit sad when they come to Laos too, because I feel like wherever they are, that's China. It's not Laos anymore. And it's worth saying that this person also expressed some regret that he was too old to learn Chinese and go to university in China itself. Perhaps, again, a sign of this minorities being more willing and more open-minded to partner with the Chinese. But overall, it's not very unusual for people to complain about China on one hand, but then talk about wanting to go there or buy products at the same time. Chinese products in Laos are shedding their historic reputation for being of poor quality. And crucially, development here, again, means developing with, or at least with the influence of someone. As Nixon pointed out, this means unimagining the boundaries of Anderson's imagined community and taking in new vistas of possibility with their associated opportunities and anxieties. China then represents different things in Laos, many of which are contradictory. And my interlocutors engage with future building individually and collectively in this shifting landscape. In contrast to some of the alarmist media coverage about China in Laos and indeed elsewhere in the global south, on the ground in Laos, I think people see it as good and bad. I hear the positive in sentiments such as those speaking to China as a force for assisting with development. I hear the negative in sentiments that say, where the Chinese are, that's not Laos anymore. And I hear it too in the words of a young Lao man who told me that in 30 years, his local area will all be Chinese. And he told me that nearly 10 years ago. I argue that China is both an opportunity and an anxiety. These voices are unwilling to be as categorically positive as the newspaper article with which I opened this paper, but nor are they rejecting the idea altogether. And they understand fine well that development is complicated, it's contradictory. China is an example of how it could develop, a possibility, but also an anxiety about what the consequences of that could be. Of course, then all development means change, and Chinese-backed development is no exception to that. Here, developing means developing with someone, and I believe there's a strong case to be made for viewing China and Laos as the latest in a long line of foreign influences that have involved themselves in Laos throughout its history. Moreover, if development also means developing in the image of someone, then again, this latest version of development is no exception to that either. However, I would just put a slight word of warning on that, namely that as Tan, Nyeri, and various other scholars have recognised, the speed of change here is unprecedented. That doesn't mean it's uniformly a bad thing. I've been told by a large number of expatriates that it is, but on the ground, I think it's a lot more complicated. What's missing, though, from a lot of this is the everyday, the ordinary, the lived experience, and how everyday people grapple with the world around them. I think it's very, very easy to view China either as a neo-colonizing force or not, but both of those binaries are really unhelpful because, as my interlocutors have demonstrated very clearly, development means change, and it means developing with some level of foreign influence. And as with many millions of other people across the global south, they are living in a world in which China has become increasingly prominent in both the physical and abstract landscapes of future building. And this also means taking people seriously when they pursue individual and collective choices of development with different actors. So here I think it's helpful to view this as a contested field, but that new forms of development do displace the hegemony of how to do development from the global north, which we have seen in Laos over a lot of years. And this means it's high time to think again then about how development is done, its assumptions, priorities, and processes. And I think China is a really good example of displacing that and making us think again about that. So here then, I just acknowledge the need to view these things from all angles. Of course, we need the top-down perspective of the geopolitical situation. Of course, we also need a bottom-up perspective of the everyday. And these things are not mutually exclusive. Or maybe we just need to think about these things again and recognize that these assumptions about change are assumptions. They're not fixed. And where better to start then with people who live at the sharp end of this changing landscape? What is clear is that all this is very topical and likely to become only more so as China in Laos, or global China, becomes even more of a reality and a much more immediate one. I've suggested elsewhere that how the Lao government manages the rise of China may be determinative for their own legitimacy. Logically, China is now a possibility for future building through the opportunities it offers Lao people. And in those possibilities, there are also anxieties. The possibility of this landscape physically and metaphorically changing very quickly makes this particularly fascinating to watch closely. And it should also remind us of the importance for thinking about development, process, and outcome as something plural. These things affect all of us as the geopolitical landscape shifts. And Laos is really worth watching to see how these things transpire in lived experience. Finally, as a sign of the times, some guidance on correct behavior in Laos, which as a sign of the times for sure, now exists in three languages. Thank you very much for listening.